From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Alfred Molina. He's appeared in over 30 films, including Boogie Nights, The Imposters, and Prick Up Your Ears. He co-stars in the new movie, Chocolat. Also, comic Richard Lewis on The Other Great Depression, His new memoir is about how he overcame his addictions and one or two of his many dysfunctions. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews political thrillers that could make good gifts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect George W. Bush formally resigned today as governor of Texas. Among the accomplishments of his six-year administration, he included improving schools and reducing taxes. Bush choked up as he waved goodbye to lawmakers and supporters in the state Senate chambers. His successor is Republican Lieutenant Governor Rick Perry. After his resignation speech, Bush met with 19 Republican and Democratic members of Congress for talks on education. The discussions included the president-elect's plan for local control, improving teacher quality and literacy. Tomorrow, the president-elect is expected to name more top members of his new administration, including New Jersey Governor Kristi Whitman as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The White House and the incoming Bush administration are wrangling over the state of the economy, how bad it might be, and whether talking about it makes it worse. NPR's Peter Overby has details.
The dispute has been brewing for several days as President-elect George W. Bush makes the case for the $1 trillion-plus tax cut he promised during the campaign. His rationale is that cutting taxes will stimulate the economy. White House officials question whether the economy needs that kind of stimulation. Thursday morning, President Clinton's top economic adviser said Bush was talking down the economy for short-term political positioning. Later in the day, Bush responded that he's a realist watching warning signs on the horizon. And Vice President-elect Dick Cheney invoked the name of Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Cheney said the Bush administration's views are similar to Greenspan's. The Federal Reserve has indicated it's likely to cut interest rates next year. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli and Palestinian negotiators continued their efforts to revive the peace process today in Washington. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
As the two sides consider suggestions from President Clinton on how to resolve their differences, Israeli officials express some hope about the eventual outcome. Said one, "This is the first serious attempt to deal with the core issues of the conflict in a long time." The official suggested that Israel will be more flexible on the question of Jerusalem if the other side is more flexible on the return of Palestinian refugees. Israeli diplomatic sources do not expect a breakthrough in this round of talks, but say if there's enough progress, the negotiations would move to a higher level and consultations with Arab leaders on a possible settlement would begin. A source on the Palestinian side was less optimistic, saying the Washington talks are very difficult and that it's been hard to find common ground. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 168 points, or 1.6%. They closed at 10,487 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 7 points. This is NPR News from Washington. The Clinton administration has issued rules designed to cut air pollution from diesel trucks and buses. The regulations call for more efficient engines and low-sulfur diesel fuels. The administration says they could cut pollution from diesel engines over the next 10 years. Oil refiners say the rules will be too costly. They plan to ask the incoming Bush administration to ease the standards. President Clinton will have new license plates installed on his car just in time for his last month in office. David First reports from member station WAMU in Washington.
There's no friendly slogan like the Garden State or the Sunshine State on the new D.C. tags. Taxation without representation is what the president's new plates will say. They were unveiled in the District of Columbia back in November to draw national attention to the fact that D.C. does not have voting representation in the House or the Senate. According to White House Press Secretary Jake Seward, the president decided today to install the plates as a symbol of his support.
People in the district work hard play by the rules, pay their taxes, and yet they don't have the same vote that everyone else does. And that's why the president's been a strong supporter of D.C. statehood and why he thinks these plates are important.
No word yet on whether President-elect Bush will elect to keep the plates on his limo. He's on the record as being opposed to statehood for the district. For NPR News, I'm David First in Washington.
President Clinton has signed a massive spending bill to fund education, health, and other federal programs. At the signing ceremony, he noted that education spending has almost doubled during his administration to $44 billion. That spending included more than $6 billion for Head Start, which provides preschool preparation for more than 900,000 low-income children. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alfred Molina, is one of the stars of the new film Chocolat. It's a comic fable set in the past in a small French town where the people are very repressed, until a beautiful young woman, played by Juliette Binoche, arrives with her daughter and rents a pastry shop, a pâtisserie, and transforms it into a chocolate shop. Her delicious chocolates release the customers' inhibitions and passions and slowly transform the whole town. The mayor, who is also a nobleman, played by Alfred Molina, is one of the most repressive forces in town. In an early scene, he goes to meet the exotic new stranger after she's rented the shop but hasn't yet told anyone what it will be.
To what do we owe the honor of your visit?
Well, as mayor of Lanskenet, I want to welcome you to the community and to invite you to worship with us at Mass on Sunday.
That's very kind of you, but actually we don't attend. We're glad to be so near the church, though. We'll enjoy singing with the bells, won't we, Nuno?
The bells are not intended as an entertainment, madame. They are a solemn call to worship for the...
Mademoiselle.
I beg your pardon?
Mademoiselle, I've never been married, but feel free to call me Vianne. I do hope you'll stop by when I open for business next week.
Yes. Yes, opening a patisserie during the Holy Lenten fast, I could imagine better timing.
Oh, but it's not going to be a patisserie.
Then what do you intend to...
It's a surprise. It was sweet of you to drop by.
Alfred Molina's other films include Boogie Nights, Prick Up Your Ears, and Enchanted April. He starred in the Broadway show Art and co-stars in the sitcom Ladies' Man. Alfred Molina, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In Chocolat, this movie's worldview is that, you know, people are very repressed, or at least the people in this town are very repressed, and they need this outsider to come in and give them the liberty of metaphorically eating chocolate and freeing up their ability to experience pleasure. This worldview
sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, this worldview only really applies to people who were brought up in a very repressed atmosphere and need to learn to loosen up. Were you? I mean, is this something you understand?
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, thankfully, I wasn't brought up in quite the same kind of repressed atmosphere as our characters experience in the film. Although my parents were immigrants to England. My father came from Spain. My mother from Italy. And they were both sort of left-wing liberals, although they still couldn't quite cut the umbilical cord to the church. So I was still brought up in a Catholic school. I think my father's attitude was, well, you know, just in case. And but, you know, there was that, certainly growing up in the late 50s, early 60s, there was that sense of that all the exciting stuff was happening somewhere else to someone else. I think one reason why I was so desperate to go to college away from home was to kind of get away from that, you know. So I kind of have I understood that sense of one's immediate environment closing in and sort of stopping you from experiencing the wider world.
So when you were going to Catholic school, which almost always means a strict upbringing in school, was what you were learning in school, the kind of values you were learning in school, different from the kind of lives that your parents and their left-wing friends were leading?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, there was a kind of, it was an odd sort of contradiction, although it wasn't really at the time taken terribly seriously. I mean, it manifested itself in the, for instance, at my Catholic school, Thursday morning mass was obligatory. And if you skipped it and got caught skipping it, you kind of you got into trouble. But I skipped it, and my parents always gave me an alibi. So,
like what?
Well, they would say, "Oh, yeah, he wasn't well this morning," you know, or "Yes, yeah, so he had to stay home and help his father," you know, things like that. I mean, they weren't. The only reason they sent me to the Catholic school was because it was the best school in the district.
The first role that I really noticed you in was in Prick Up Your Ears in, I think it was 1988, 87.
Before that, yeah, 87, that's right.
This is the film version of the story of British playwright Joe Orton, who was gay before it was okay to be out. And you play his older boyfriend, Kenneth Halliwell, and you start as sort of a mentor to Orton, but he outpaces you, he becomes famous, and you feel overshadowed and increasingly resentful and angry, particularly because he's always out cruising, leaving you behind. And at the end of the movie, as in real life, Halliwell kills Orton by smashing his head in with a hammer. Let me just play a clip from this movie, and this is toward the very end of the movie, when Halliwell has been talking to Orton, and Orton is becoming very dismissive of him. Halliwell has pointed out that he was his mentor, and Orton has said, you know, if it wasn't you, it would have been someone else. And this is just like really pushing you over the edge. And Joe Orton goes to sleep, basically ignoring you for the rest of the night. And you look at yourself in the mirror and say these words.
I don't understand my life. I was an only child. I lost both my parents. By the time I was 20, I was going bald. I'm a homosexual. In the way of circumstances and background, I had everything an artist could possibly want. It was practically a blueprint. I was programmed to be a novelist or a playwright. But I'm not, and you are. Joe? You do everything better than me. You even sleep better than me.
It's my guest Alfred Molina in the film Prick Up Your Ears, and this scene ends with him picking up a hammer and bashing in the head of his lover, the playwright Joe Orton. Did you know the story of Halliwell and Orton before taking on this role?
Oh yeah, very much so. It was a great scandal at the time. You know, when it happened, you know, Joe Orton was this hugely successful young playwright. He had such great promise. You know, already a handful of successful, very provocative plays. He'd just won a couple of major writing awards on the London theatre scene, and he was a star. He was a bona fide literary star, and also not only that, a very popular one. His plays had done very, very well box office wise, critically. And there was talk of him doing screenplays for... I think at one point he was even approached by the Beatles' management to write a screenplay for them. I think he even delivered a screenplay, which was turned down.
What was your interpretation of Kenneth Halliwell and why he killed his lover, Joe Orton? And what did you do to find out more about him?
Well, Gary Oldman, who played Joe Orton, and I, we were already friends before that. We'd done a Mike Leigh film together a couple of years before, and we knew each other well, and we just went off and did some detective work. We got in touch with John Lahr, who wrote the almost definitive biography on Joe Orton. And we just sort of rifled through his files, and he gave us complete access to all his archival material and all the material that he'd accrued over the years while he was researching for the book. And we just spent a lot of time pouring through all this material, trying to make sense of this relationship and why, you know, what is it that drives of someone who starts off as a teacher, as a mentor? What happens when that relationship shifts, when the student overtakes the teacher, when the student actually becomes more knowing, more knowledgeable, more powerful, more successful than the teacher? And if that relationship is confused and complicated by this personal element, the fact that they were lovers, somehow, how does that, we realize that it was in there that was the dramatic potential. It wasn't so much, I think, just going through a factual appraisal of what happened and why was far less interesting to us than really finding out what happened in that moment, that moment of fire, that moment when those two worlds clash and they find themselves suddenly becoming not getting what they need from each other, when the relationship ceased to be symbiotic, when it became kind of dependent and needy. And I think Ken's problem was that he couldn't function socially without Joe. Joe was the social one. Joe was the gregarious one. Ken was, in fact, became for Joe increasingly an embarrassment socially. There's lots of evidence from Joe's diaries, from diaries of other people who were friends of theirs, that Joe's friends would dread Ken arriving. They would often invite Joe and pray that he would come on his own, because Ken was became like a liability.
When you made this movie in 1987, there was still actors still, I think, were afraid for the most part to play a gay character out of fear that they'd never be able to play a straight man again. Was there any after effects of playing a gay character in this movie?
Not for me, except that I got some terrible beard rash from kissing Gary first thing in the morning. Gary would often not forget to shave. But I'm being facetious. But I think when the film came along, I didn't think twice. I suddenly thought, this is a fantastic role. This is a great film. These are wonderful actors. This is a great director. I'd be foolish. Their homosexuality was an important ingredient, but it wasn't a film about being gay. It was a film about being in love and being destroyed by it.
Was the reaction you got from casting directors, for instance, any different in England than it was in the U.S.?
No, in England, it was kind of accepted as another actor just accepting another role. There wasn't. Where I found the most surprise was when I came to the States. After the film was successful in England and it did well here, like every English actor, you kind of come and do the what John Borman calls the inevitable pilgrimage. You come to Hollywood to see if you can make some money. And I remember walking into a casting session, and by that time my hair had grown back, I'd lost the weight I'd put on for the film, and I walked into this casting session, and this casting director said, "Oh my God, you're not bald. I guess you're not gay either, right?" And I said, and then trying to brighten the moment, I said, "Yes, and I'm not a murderer either," which went completely over his head. And I realized that all I could see in his eyes was deep disappointment. He was expecting to see, Alfred Molina, that bald gay guy, he didn't get that. And so I think, I was off the list.
My guest is actor Alfred Molina. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Alfred Molina is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie, Chocolat. Let me ask you about your role in Boogie Nights. And this was a film from a few years ago that was made by Paul Thomas Anderson. It's a movie about the porn industry in the 1970s.
I sure know how to pick them, don't I?
you're terrific in this movie. This is a real favorite scene of mine. In this scene, two of the porn stars from the story, played by Mark Wahlberg and John C. Reilly, are taken by a friend who they don't really trust to your place, and you're a drug dealer, and they're intending on selling you some drugs, and you're there wearing this silver robe that's untied, revealing you in these red bikini briefs and nothing else, and you're
I'm glad you noticed.
You're smoking. I don't know whether it's marijuana or crack or something. You're smoking.
Oh, it was supposed to be a crack pipe. Yeah.
Okay, so you're smoking crack with a blowtorch, and listening to this mixtape that you made, and you're absolutely out of your mind, and you have a friend or assistant in your house is setting off these firecrackers, which is really driving the other characters crazy because it sounds like gunshots. And it's this really mad scene where two of the characters are absolutely insane, you and the friend who's brought the other two porn stars over. And so you're listening to this mixtape, and it starts to play Jesse's Girl, and you're singing along with the tape.
Dude, I love this. Like, I make these little mixtapes together. You know, I put all my favorite songs together. Hey, Charles, which one is this? Number 11, yeah. I love it. You know, when you buy a tape or something or an album, you put it on, and the songs are like the fans put them in some f***ing order. Like, they want you to listen to it in that order. You know, I hate that. I don't like to be told what to listen to, when to listen to it, or anything.
Something's changed, it ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl, and I wanna make her mine. And she's watching in Willow's eyes, and she's loving with the fire, I just know it.
Ricky Springfield, the fire of mine.
You are really so magnetic in this movie, and I'm wondering how you worked out this scene with the director, Paul Thomas Anderson. How big to make the character?
Well, what
kind of tips did he give you about what he wanted to see from you in this scene?
Well, he just kept saying, "Have fun, go crazy. We can always reduce it. Give you know, go wherever you want to go, and we'll I'll bring it down. It's going to be easier for me to tone it down than it is to kind of build it up. Just go for it." He was very sort of, it was like, I felt like an athlete being kind of given a pep talk before a big game or something. He was very, very free. Paul is one of those directors, a bit like Lasse Hallström, who clearly loves what actors can do. He enjoys watching actors. He enjoys their contribution to a film, and he allows them a lot of room, a lot of freedom. And I've always found that the best work comes out of those situations rather than situations of that are adversarial or conflicted, you know, people sort of having huge rows about something, and he just said, "Have fun, you know, go crazy."
In the part where you're singing along with your mixtape, we've all seen people play air guitar. You're playing air piano in this.
That's right.
And lip syncing and singing out loud with the song, actually. And you're doing it in such a broad way because you're incredibly high. Tell me about capturing that kind of, you know, air guitar lip syncing.
Well, this is the moment where I probably blow my cover as far as all your audience is concerned. I'm afraid I am the great sort of, you know, in the privacy of your own front room, I am a great rock star. I think if I had a dollar for every hour I've spent miming to records in my life, I think I'd be independently rich. It's something I've always loved. I can't even believe I'm admitting this. It's something I've always done ever since I was a kid. I used to put the record on and just mime to it, learn all the words, you know, work out dance routines, and you know, mime playing guitar and drums and stuff. I've always done it, and I still do it, much to my wife's consternation and confusion. I mean, because she says my favorite instrument is the dashboard. I am the archetypal. I'm the guy at the traffic lights tapping on the steering wheel, who thinks he's, you know, Ringo Starr or someone.
Now, you're physically really different in this scene than you are in Prick Up Your Ears, and these movies were made about 10 years apart. You're much bigger in Prick Up Your Ears. Mm. You're much slimmer in Boogie Nights, and we see your whole body because all you're wearing is this open robe and the red bikini briefs. So what are the physical differences between what you did for each role? You put on weight for Prick Up Your Ears?
I'm one of nature's fat boys. There's a big fat man bursting out of me, and so I've always had my weight goes up and down, and what I often try and do is try and lose weight or put on weight depending on what the requirements are. But fortunately, with Boogie Nights, I'd just come back from shooting a movie in Russia, consequently, I came back somewhat slimmer than I was when I left. So I came back and went to do Boogie Nights instantly, and so I was fortunately I was able to. I wish I could say to you, yes, I went on a diet, I worked really hard. I just happened to be thinner at that point. But I've done that. You know, I blame Robert De Niro. It all started when Robert De Niro put on and lost 50 pounds for Raging Bull. He completely rewrote the rule book as far as what was expected from actors.
Oh, I know what you mean, and I think in some ways it was a bad thing.
I can never forgive him for that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that actors should have to physically alter their body like that for roles.
Well, I think there's a certain responsibility. If you're playing, particularly if you're playing a character who actually exists or existed in history and is well known enough that people know what he or she looks like, I think there's a certain obligation to at least try and approximate the way they look. I think it's just not really fair on the audience to expect them to suspend their disbelief to that extent. But certainly when you're dealing with fictitious characters that are purely, you know, invented for that movie or for that play, then I think in a way it's, you know, however you look is right. But I've played a lot of real characters, people that really existed, and it's, I quite enjoy that challenge of, you know, trying to change yourself physically a little bit. I love messing about with, you know, hair and stuff like that, you know, and it's an element of acting that I've always enjoyed, that part that's kind of part sort of pretend and make believe and, you know, dressy up, you know. I quite like all that.
Alfred Molina co-stars in the new film Chocolat. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler, a collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, comic Richard Lewis on the other Great Depression, his. Maureen Corrigan reviews political thrillers that she recommends as gifts, and we continue our conversation with actor Alfred Molina.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Alfred Molina. He's co-starring in the new movie Chocolat. His other movies include Boogie Nights, Prick Up Your Ears, Enchanted April, and The Imposters. His sitcom Ladies' Man will return to CBS as a mid-season replacement. You're half Spanish and half Italian. How do you think that's affected your casting?
Well, I think it's given me a certain look, a certain kind of, you know, sort of dark look. You know, I remember one reason why I decided to come and live in the States was that the great thing about living in America is that everybody here at some point or other came from somewhere else. And there's a, you know, being the fact that I was Spanish, half Italian, meant that I was just one part of a much, much wider ethnic spectrum in terms of the actors that were out there. In England, I was always kind of slightly viewed as being just a little bit foreign. You know, oh yes, well, Fred can't, you know, I mean, you'll never see me in a Merchant Ivory movie simply because I'm just not English enough, you know. But here in the States, I can be English, I can be Greek, I can be Iranian, Russian, you know, Israeli. It's fantastic.
Right, you were Iranian in the movie, what's it called, Not Without My Daughter, where Sally
Field... Yeah, or
Field...
Not Without My Per Diem, as we refer to it. It was a nice big studio picture, so there was lots of nice per diem.
That's funny. See, you must have had to learn a lot of accents over the years.
Yeah, I haven't. And again, you know, as I was saying earlier about this whole thing about, you know, the make-believe, pretend part of acting, the bit where you, as Anthony Hopkins often says, you know, he was asked once, how did he prepare for the part of Hannibal Lecter? And he looked the journalist very coolly in the eye and said, I made it up. And I think that's part of the joy, making it all up, you know. And the accent thing is a lot of fun, I find. I enjoy that process. I always have done.
Do you have coaches for that?
No. I've always for some accents I've had to have a coach. Yeah, especially if there's something that I have no connection with. But you know, I grew up with immigrant parents. We lived in a part of London that was full of other immigrant families. So I grew up and I went to school. At my school, all the kids in my school were essentially first generation in England. And there was Irish kids, Polish, West Indian, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese. And there was a this incredible mix of sounds and rhythms that I grew up with. And I think sort of even without trying, I think I kind of developed an ear for accents, or at least for the different rhythms. And so I've always enjoyed doing it. I've always had a... I've never been frightened by it.
Your next movie, I think, is Texas Rangers.
That's right, a Western, would you believe?
Is that a good thing that it's a Western?
Oh yeah, I'm only saying that because I'm very proud of the fact that I've done some Westerns. I like, because it's again another.
Did you grow up with Westerns?
Yeah, you have to remember that in England, particularly in the late 50s, early 60s, popular American culture was very, very pervasive, and. You know, something like 40% or 50% of television output in England in those days came from America. All those Western shows, you know, Have Gun Will Travel, Gunsmoke, Gun Law, The Virginian, Bonanza. We saw all those shows. And I remember playing in the street, playing cowboys and Indians and cops and robbers in the street, and we would play with American accents. we'd borrow all the dialogue from shows that we were watching on TV. So you'd have all these English kids running around saying, you know, hit them off at the pass, you know, I got you covered, you know, all that cliche dialogue. And it was, we kind of grew up with that stuff. And the idea of being in a Western, getting to, you know, shoot, spit and smoke and get paid for it, you know, it was fantastic.
So when you were watching Westerns in England, did you assume that America was like that?
I think I must have done at some point. I think when I was very young, my image of America was huge, huge, endless prairies full of these very, very handsome people, kind of, you know, lean,
all
slim,
wearing leather.
You know, all wearing leather. Says a lot about me, doesn't it? Or the other image I had was New York, you know, tenements and steam coming out of, you know, the pavements and sort of... guns and moles and gangsters, you know. And when I first came to America, the very first time we came here, I remember my wife and I were in the back of a taxi from Kennedy Airport going across the bridge into Manhattan, and we saw that suddenly you see that amazing skyline. And we both burst into tears because we'd never been there before, but it was instantly recognisable. You know, New York being probably the most photogenic city in the world and certainly one of the most photographed. You know, every corner we turned, we were there for about 10 days. We walked everywhere, and every corner you turned, you saw something that you recognised from a movie or a TV show, and it was the most extraordinary experience. And then, of course, you learn how New York and LA are so unrepresentative of the rest of the country, that there's this whole other America in between the two cities that is well worth as much of your time as anything else. You know, and I've actually driven across country now 3 times. I absolutely love it. You know, it's fantastic.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Alfred Molina co-stars in the new movie Chocolat. Coming up, comic Richard Lewis on overcoming his addictions and a couple of dysfunctions. This is Fresh Air. Just in time for the holiday season, comic Richard Lewis has a memoir about depression and how he gave up drinking and other addictions and overcame at least a couple of his many dysfunctions. The memoir is called The Other Great Depression. Lewis has built his stand-up career on talking about his problems, but in his memoir, he's more interested in trying to be honest than in going for laughs. Lewis has been featured in several films, including Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and Drunks. He starred opposite Jamie Lee Curtis in the sitcom Anything But Love, and he plays himself on Curb Your Enthusiasm, the new HBO series created by and starring Larry David, the co-creator of Seinfeld. Now, you know, in your comedy act, some of the things you've always traded on are your neurosis, your hypochondria, the rashes you'd get, how depressed you were.
A little cold in the studio, too, I might add. Getting
exactly.
A little bit of a chill.
So what was it like, you know, talking about your neurosis and your hypochondria, knowing that you had a really serious problem that wasn't imagined, it wasn't hypochondria, it was your drinking?
Well, I'll tell you, here's the thing. First of all, you know, for the vast majority of my career, I wasn't an alcoholic. And when I was an alcoholic, I quit stand-up because I didn't, you know, I loved the craft so much. That I didn't want to, like, you know, didn't want to be found out. And then when I went back on stage, like I said, I tried my best to be as sober as I possibly could be when I was, you know, doing my craft. But it was, you know, after hours. You know, I did most of the damage alone or, you know, socializing. And, of course, you know, toward the end, you know, when you really can't control how many drinks you have if you're an alcoholic, you know, you'll do it at places where you certainly don't want to look like a fool, like, you know, at screenings and, you know, when there's like, you know, 120 power brokers from town. And I, you know, that's happened from time to time.
Did you ever incorporate drinking into your stand-up routine? I don't mean drinking during the routine. I mean talking about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I, well, certainly ever since I got sober, it was, I slowly but surely talked about, you know, the disease of alcoholism. I remember I did a special back in 96 called the Magical Misery Tour. Well, that was the tour, but the special was the Magical Misery Concert. And I, as a throwaway, because I was still a little nervous about it, I said that I took some time off and I watched the Recovery Channel. Ironically, there is a Recovery Channel now. But certainly in the last 2-3 years, you know, I ad-lib a lot on stage. I carry around in my head about 6 or 7 or 8 hours of new material. And a lot of that is about recovery, and it is about alcoholism and drug abuse. And with great pride now, I say it, as happy as I am writing about it in my book, I am also on stage, and it gives me great pleasure when I would notice an audience member perhaps sort of elbow their significant other and go, you see, he can talk about it, and he's healthy now, and, you know, what about you? I mean, I really see that, and sometimes an audience's eyes, you know, and it's it brings me a lot of pleasure.
Richard Lewis is my guest. He's a comic and actor who's just written a memoir about overcoming alcoholism and several other problems.
Thousand.
And dysfunctions. Yeah. Yes, addictions, dysfunctions, etc. It's called The Other Great Depression. Unfortunately, the language of recovery has become in some circles such a cliched language,
mm-hmm.
The way a lot of things become when they're used and overused a lot. So what's it been like for you as somebody who uses language really well as a comic to try to find a language to discuss something that has become, as important as it is, something of a cliché? It's in a way particularly clichéd for people who are performers and in show business. There are so many people in show business who've had problems with drugs and alcohol. We've heard many of their stories. And so you must have had this fear of speaking really from your heart and having it be heard as a cliché.
Well, you know, that's a very good point. That's why I don't really talk, you know, try not to use the jargon too much, because, you know, here, like, for example, this is something that I've heard a lot early on, and this is precisely what you're talking about, that alcoholism is a very selfish disease, but that's a very important thing for people to realize, because when you are drunk and not in recovery, all you really do care about is chasing that high and that rush, and consequently you forget about people, you forget about a quality life. But when you do decide that life is precious enough and you have to just give up drinking or drugs, then you have to become selfish and only think of yourself and realize that nothing is more important than not drinking, assuming you're an alcoholic. And that's how I live my life now. I let nothing else take precedent over not drinking. You know, then I let everything else, you know, just, you know, fall into place, because I'll never forget, you know, the dark days.
You know, you write a little bit about your parents in your new book, and you say that when you told your mother that you knew you were an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
which is a really good sign that you could accept the fact that you were and therefore make a change.
Right.
Her reaction was not the reaction you wanted her to have. What was her reaction?
Well, you know, my mom passed away this year, and my dad passed away when I was, you know, even back way early, you know, back in 1971. And so it was very difficult to write about them. But my mom's reaction was, unfortunately, one of embarrassment. And, you know, and I understand that. But, you know, I think that I was, unfortunately, to her, you know, she was stuck in time where, you know, a child is like more of a reflection of who she is than who, you know, my authentic self was. And, you know, and I was authentically, you know, a successful comedian and also authentically a successful drunk, you know. So, but at that point, when I told her, a successful recovering alcoholic. So I just think she was embarrassed, you know. I think there was a part of her way down deep buried that she was proud that I wasn't drinking anymore. But I think she couldn't, you know, shout to the rafters, my son's proudly a recovering alcoholic. I just think it's something that, you know, is so ingrained in her that it was, you know, that it was a little too late in her life to change.
Was she able to accept it when you did comedy about your parents?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, my mother had a great sense of humor, and I'm not mean-spirited. I can really say that. And my comedy, when I talk about other people, it's, you know, the craft of comedy is, you know, hyperbole certainly is a big part of it. And I would exaggerate, but always the truth. And she would be the first to admit, at least privately, that she would do that. You know, I mean, I remember a joke I wrote like 30 years ago, and I use this because it was very economical, and I'm sort of proud of the joke because it was a good joke. It was about how bored I would be driving across country with my family, and how unspontaneous they would be, and how it would drive me crazy. And I, of course, I embellished it. We never did drive across country, but I had us backing out of our driveway from our hometown in Englewood, New Jersey, driving to San Francisco, and her jiggling something in her hand. I said, "Mother, what is that? What are you doing? You're making me crazy." And she says, "I have the tolls ready for the Golden Gate Bridge." And that to me was, you know, would have basically... And audiences always screamed at that because, you know, I had to set it up properly, but that was like, you drive with this family for 3,300 miles. You know, that's where it was at. And when I would say something that would really hit home... She would never get angry. In fact, she would sometimes call me at the hotel in New York and say, "Don't forget to mock me tonight on Letterman." You know what I mean? So I think she had a love-hate thing with it, you know?
Yeah, well, when you talk about your neurosis, I can relate to some of that and say, yeah, no, that's really funny, and maybe I'll feel a little bit better about myself. So are you going to feel better about yourself if I laugh at your jokes about
Absolutely.
Your neuroses?
I really do feel validated, you know, that I'm not alone. I do. There's no question I feel less alone. I mean, there's nothing worse when I try to, you know, have a riff on stage about a problem that's making me depressed, and I'm looking at an audience, be it 300 or 3,000, and there's silence. I'm saying, wow. I mean, there's a thin line between narcissism and entertainment, and that's pure narcissism, you know, and you really try to, you know, my goal is to entertain people, but if I can entertain them and get laughs to boot and applause about problems that I'm having, it only means, like what you just said, that, you know, they can relate, and that's my goal.
Well, the last thing you want to do is to share your problems on stage in a way that you think is really funny, and instead of people laughing, they feel sorry for you. Has that ever happened to you?
Yes. Once I said, I'm not a complainer, and 3,000 people moaned. if there was a trap door in that concert hall, I would have gone down it. I really had to explain to them. They really didn't understand. It became like a lecture for about 10 minutes. You know, I used this metaphor back in the early 70s. And I didn't intentionally mean it as a hook, but it became one, and I had to stop it. It was a third-person thing, things from hell, like a date from hell, or, you know, my mother from hell, boss from hell, you name it. And it was basically to say that I'm a survivor and that these people or these things were driving me crazy. And, you know, I ultimately had to stop saying, boy, did I have an evening from hell, because... You know, first it was used all the time. It was used in advertisements. It was used in movie promos, and other comics were using it. And I sort of felt like I was ripping myself off at that point.
Your comedy has always been about, yourself and neurosis,
right,
and hypochondria, et cetera. How did you know when you started in comedy that you were going to be your subject matter and that your insecurities were going to be what your comedy was about?
Well, you know, when I started out in like 71, you know, a lot of comedy was, you know, observational comedy. And, you know, one of the reasons I went on stage is because I felt, you know, very alienated. You know, I didn't get the kind of nurturing that I felt. I just didn't feel nurtured and appreciated as much as probably I wanted to. So I needed the adulation from strangers, really, from audiences. And when I was starting to, I started writing jokes before I went on stage for, as they say, these Catskill comedians and Borschtbelt comedians. And they were rejecting most of the good stuff. And most of the good stuff was my real feelings about myself. And that was a real sign that, you know, I had to go on stage and do these jokes rather than throw them out. And they were about me. And plus, I felt so judged growing up that I didn't really like to get on stage and tell audiences, you know, did you ever notice this? Did you ever notice when you do that, that you feel this way? That was the last thing I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was talk about how I was feeling and pray to God that it was relatable and that people laughed. And you know, 3 decades later, they still are mostly. So I guess I struck a nerve.
One last question. Have you had any new rashes lately?
I will probably get one when I leave the studio, worrying about how I did with you.
Fair enough.
But I'll break out in NPR. I promise you that on my thigh.
Okay. Richard Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Richard Lewis has a new memoir called The Other Great Depression. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan recommends political thrillers for holiday reading and gift giving. This is Fresh Air. Are you still seeing visions of dangling chads instead of sugar plums? Book critic Maureen Corrigan has some holiday reading recommendations that blend politics and escape.
For those political obsessives on your holiday shopping list who feel bereft now that the presidential race has been decided and CNN is no longer in its emergency alert mode, how about a fictional substitute? How about a stocking full of political thrillers? Truth may still be stranger than fiction, as our recent electoral realities demonstrate. But in fiction, or at least in these novels, readers get the satisfaction of learning the real, down-and-dirty political maneuverings behind the public cover-ups and conciliatory speeches. The First Counsel, by Washington lawyer-turned-Grishamite thriller writer Brad Meltzer, exudes the same kind of insider appeal as do most episodes of The West Wing. The hapless hero here is a young White House lawyer named Michael Garrick, who finds himself dating the president's daughter, Nora Hartson, a wildcat who just can't say no to drugs or danger. On their first date, Michael and Nora witness the White House counsel making a money drop in a secluded park. Soon, bodies are bleeding all over the city's plush corridors of power, and Michael fears that the last line on his resume will read, "Fall Guy." Meltzer's plot is satisfyingly intricate and swift, and his characters are fleshed out in unexpected ways. But like I said, the most entertaining aspect of The First Counsel is its aura of being in the know about the inner life of the White House. I was hooked before page one when I read this juicy epigraph by former first daughter Lucy Johnson. "I resented a lot about the White House," Johnson said. "Then I realized I could adjust, or I could adjust." LBJ's daughter's delightfully impolitic peevishness is followed by pages of hush-hush detail, like what's featured on the daily White House mess menu, and why the White House heating and cooling systems keep the air pressure higher than normal to suck poison-filled air away from the president in case of gas attack. Meltzer also mentions something called the toaster that keeps track of the whereabouts of every member of the first family. Is any of this information true, and why did I relish it so? Beats me. But that's one of the marks of a good writer. He or she makes you care about a world you didn't even know existed. Ken Follett's latest, Code to Zero, is primarily set in Cold War Washington. And much as I like Follett, if you put me under oath, I'd have to testify that this is one of those lightweight literary efforts that leaves you feeling guilty about precious hours of your life dribbling by. My excuse for reading this novel is that the first third or so is really ingenious, and so I was duped. Code to Zero opens in a men's room in Union Station in Washington, where a drunk awakens with a terrific hangover and without any memory. Within the space of a frantic, bullet-ridden day, this ersatz drunk, who's really, among other things, a former OSS agent, solves the mystery of his missing identity. The process through which he puts the pieces together really makes for exciting reading. One more caveat, though. If you do decide to read Code to Zero, just know that it contains one of the silliest descriptions of the female orgasm I've ever come across. Hard to believe this is the same guy who wrote those smoldering sex scenes in Eye of the Needle. For sheer suspense and unsentimental sucker punch plot twists, my top pick of these holiday thrillers would be Daniel Silva's The Kill Artist, a spy versus spy fatal game of wits. In his previous books, Silva convincingly mined the espionage field of World War II. Here, he's written a contemporary story about Mideast tensions going global. Gabriel Alon was a crackerjack operative in the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, but he retired to the controlled world of art restoration after his wife and son were blown up by a car bomb. When the novel opens, Alon has been seduced back into service to do battle with the Palestinian assassin who destroyed his family and who now plans to murder Yasser Arafat. I know the plot sounds cardboard, but Silva is a scrupulous writer who really brings to life a secret world within a world. A place where death by nail file seems a plausible end, and violence is politics by other means.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Phyllis Myers, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Our engineer today was Bob Purdick. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from HarperCollins Children's Books and Joanna Kotler Books, publishers of Penelope Jane, A Fairy Tale, a picture book and CD package by Roseanne Cash. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Ethan Coen, co-creator of the films Fargo, Raising Arizona, and Blood Simple. The Coen brothers have a new film called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Also, Otis Williams of The Temptations, the only original member still with the group. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.